Eddie, the 10-year reunion. Chapter 10. Moving Forward, Part 2. As the summer comes to a close, the group meets at the county pool for their annual reunion. As the morning moves on, everyone trickles in a few at a time. Instead of a row of 8 matching June buggies, now that many in the group have kids, there are a few matching Volkswagen buses in the parking lot. Joining the group this year is Angela Meadows, from the television station, Karen Coy, who ran track at the university years ago, Lynn Burson, Penny Hart, Daniel Gaspari, Daryl Stone, Mr. Fraser, Coach Athena Layton, and a few others. The summer reunion still brings the annual 100-yard freestyle rematch between Tessa and Eddie. Eddie kicked Tessa's, but the day after the reunion in a 200-yard freestyle ocean swim, and Tessa knows it. Tessa, although she doesn't display it, is very worried that Eddie will beat her this year. Eddie, as Tessa has come to expect, is making no comment this year about how or if he's been training. Truth be told, Tessa is already psyched up and wants this race over with as soon as possible. Walking into the pool area, Kathy tells Eddie they got a new sign. Reading the sign aloud, Kathy reads, "Lifeguard on duty." Reading the smaller print at the bottom of the sign, Kathy reads, "Please use caution. There is no lifeguard on duty in the gene pool." Eddie laughs and replies, "That's really funny. I want one of those for our pool." Kathy and Eddie walk toward the deep end of the pool, where their friends are sitting at the tables, and take a seat. At one of the tables, as they are relaxing, Braden tells Mark, "I'm gonna need your help again." Mark asks, "What's up?" Braden replies, "I bought the house next door to me. I want to knock it down." Quite surprised, Mark interrupts and asks, "Why do you want to knock it down?" Braden replies, "Wendy really wants an organic vegetable garden. I also want to make a place that Wendy can use her telescope where there ain't gonna be any lights from the house bothering her. And our whole backyard is taken up by the pool, the patio, and my outdoor kitchen. And I can't exactly put a vegetable garden in my front yard." Hearing the discussion between Braden and Mark, Wendy leaves the table where she is seated and pulls up a chair. Wendy asks Mark, "Can you knock the house down for us?" Mark replies, "Sure. No problem. All we have to do is get a demolition permit and start knocking it down." Mark then asks, "Does it have a basement?" Braden replies, "No." Mark informs Braden that will make it easier. If it had a basement, it's a pain in the ass to demolish the concrete walls. And we'd also have to bring in a shitload of fill dirt. Braden tells Mark, "Here's what I was thinking. I want to continue my wall around that property and put in a gate in my backyard to get to the garden." Mark explains, "We can do that. And you might want to put a large gate in the front yard in case you want to drive a vehicle into the garden someday. You might also want to leave the water service on for that property and get John to put in an irrigation system. And remember, there's a 15-foot setback for the wall from the road." Braden replies, "I'll just fill the front in with grass and put in a park bench so people can sit and talk." Wanting to expand her plant collection, Wendy suggests, "We can put a few plants outside the wall, too." With less lawn to cut, Braden replies, "That sounds good to me." Braden asks, "Can you put my job on your schedule?" Mark replies, "Sure. I can go down on Monday and apply for the demolition permit. In the meantime, draw up some rough plans of what you want." Now all excited, Wendy tells Mark, "I'll take care of that." Wendy is taking no chances. She will make sure her garden is laid out exactly the way she wants. Best of all, Wendy likes the fact that Mark makes construction sound so easy. Arriving last to the party is Johnson, who comments to Mark, "This should be a peaceful day. All the riffraff is in jail." Mark replies, "Let's see. Chuck is in jail with that goldshit guy and that Bitch Creek girl, Terry Haynes. Mr. Crumb is back in jail. O'Brien is in jail. McCrutchen and Evans are in jail. Did I miss anybody? Johnson smiles, telling Mark, that's about it. Those guys all take the gold medal in causing trouble. Mark asks Johnson, does any of that shit still go on at the high school that happened when we were there? Johnson replies, sure it does. But, I see it from the other side now. Mark asks, really? Like what? Johnson explains, the left side of the storage building you built is the favorite place for the students to hang out and smoke pot before school and at lunch. You can't see that side of the building from the school or from the administration building. If someone is cutting class, that's probably the first place you'll find them. Mark confesses, I never thought about that when me and my dad put that building up. Johnson asks Mark, do you remember the guy on the high school track team, Eddie Lee Washington? Mark replies, yeah. He was actually really good. Johnson replies, he is. He reminds me a lot of Braden. So, there's a guy in his class, Mike Zucker. Zucker is pretty much the class idiot. Mark asks, like the Chucky? Johnson replies, more like the Chucky and Jimmy O'Brien all rolled into one. Johnson explains, so, Zucker was being a pain in the ass last year and started messing with Washington. Washington is kind of quiet off the track and just ignored Zucker. During a flag football game in gym class, Washington got his flag pulled by Jason Osborne, who is also on the track team. After Washington got his flag pulled, Zucker decided to act a little cool and tackled Washington from behind. Mark laughs and comments that probably didn't go over too well. Johnson replies, it didn't. But, for the moment, Washington let it go. Johnson continues, so, get this. That day, the quarterback of Zucker's team was Jason Osborne. When Osborne's team got possession of the ball, Washington told his buddy, Osborne, hand the ball off to Zucker. He's all mine. Osborne agreed. Washington then told his team to stay out of the way, and he'll take care of Zucker. So, the ball is snapped, and Osborne hands off to Zucker. Washington charges Zucker, picks him up, and runs with Zucker over his shoulder to the end zone. When Washington got to the end zone, he slammed Zucker to the ground and yelled out, safety. 2 points. Zucker was really slow to get up after that. Mark laughs and tells Johnson, that must have been kind of funny. I wish I was there to see that. Johnson finishes the story, telling Mark, when Zucker got back from the end zone, he was really mad and yelled out at me, did you see that? I told him, well, you wanted to play tackle. Deal with it. Zucker was ticked off, but that's the way it goes. Mark observes, wow. Not much has changed. Johnson thinks for a moment and asks Mark, do you want to hear a really good one? Mark replies, sure. Johnson explains, some of the students found a way to get on the roof. From what the girls who got caught said, they've been going up there for years. One girl was a senior, and she said that she's been going up on the roof since she was a freshman. And, get this. When she was a freshman, one of the seniors told her that she has been going up there for 4 years. So, that's been going on for at least 7 years, and no one knew about it. Now curious, Mark mentions, I wonder if that was going on when we were in school. Johnson replies, it probably was. We just never knew about it. Mark asks, what's the big deal about going out on the roof? I mean, I'm guessing there's not much to do up there. Johnson replies, there were a dozen students going up there, laying out in the sun when they should have been in class. They even had chaise lounges up on the roof. Mark laughs and exclaims, wow. How did they catch them? Johnson replies, I caught them. I was out on the track one spring with my PE class, and I saw them up on the roof from a distance when they stood up. If I didn't catch them that day, they'd be up there next year too. Mark asks, so, how did they get on the roof, anyway? Johnson explains, Mr. Barrett never locks the door to the band room. But here's the problem. The band room adjoins the auditorium. The band room is where the actors all hang out during a school play until their part comes up. So you can walk from the band room right out onto the stage. In the auditorium, there's a stairway backstage going up to the catwalk where the lighting is. At the other end of the catwalk, there's a door leading to the roof. Mark asks, "Wow, how did they solve that problem?" Johnson replies, "They put a deadbolt on the door in the band room leading to the auditorium. So, now you need a key to get onto the stage. Before that, there was no lock on that door." Getting everyone's immediate attention, Barbara announces, "It's time for the annual rematch between Eddie and Tessa. Afterwards, we all can have lunch." Mark and Johnson stand up and walk to the pool's edge. While they are waiting for the race to begin, Mark asks Johnson, "Who was that girl that had a really good suntan every year when we were in school?" Johnson asks, "Are you talking about Nicole and Roberta?" Mark replies, "Yeah. Nicole. That's her name. Now I'm wondering if she was up on the roof laying out when we were in school." Mark thinks for a moment, then comments, "Now, I'm going to look through my yearbook and see if she was in the school play. Those actors and stage crew people probably knew all about how to get on the roof." Johnson replies, "Just like we knew every square inch of the track." Tessa walks over to Eddie, telling him, "I hope you're ready. This is a pool, buddy, not an ocean." Eddie looks around at the water and replies, "Really? So, that's what that thing is in my backyard." Reminding Eddie of last year's race that she won, Tessa tells Eddie, "I've been training in the ocean since our little race at the beach. I'm beating you again this year, buddy." Reminding Tessa of the outcome of the ocean swim, Eddie replies to Tessa, "That's what you said a few weeks ago. And this is this year." Concerned, yet displaying confidence, Tessa reminds Eddie, "I beat you 3 years in a row. Let that sink in." Kathy walks over to Laura, the senior lifeguard, who is also a student at the university, telling her that Eddie and Tessa are ready for their annual race. This year, Gina, a first-year lifeguard at the pool, is asked if she would like to join the race. Without hesitation, Gina, who also attends the university, agrees. Eddie, Tessa, and Gina get warmed up, ready to fight it out for the title of this year's winner. As the swimmers are warming up, Barbara whispers to Kathy and Paula, "Gina, the lifeguard, obviously has some experience. Look at how she's warming up." Kathy and Paula both observe that Gina might just have some advanced experience in the water. Laura asks the three nervous racers if everyone is ready. Answering for the group, Tessa confidently replies, "Let's get this show on the road." Eddie takes lane 2, Tessa takes lane 3, and Gina lane 4. Walking along the edge of the pool, Laura tells everyone to step back 4 feet from the pool's edge. The crowd lining the pool's edge gets larger, with many spectators wondering what the big attraction is. Laura announces, "Take your mark." With everyone in position, Laura blows her whistle. Eddie, Tessa, and Gina dive in, giving the spectators the impression that they have done this at least once before. Halfway through the first lap, Eddie is in the lead, as Tessa has come to expect. Eddie's leg strength always affords him the lead right off the block. Tessa gains on Eddie and arrives at the wall first, surprising Eddie. Eddie touches the wall second and, with a powerful flip turn, gains on Tessa, taking the lead. Gina, quite surprised at the level of her competition, touches third and, with a flawlessly artistic flip turn, swims underwater for a prolonged distance and catches up to her competitors. During the second lap of the four-lap race, showing Kathy her stopwatch, Barbara mentions to Kathy, "Check this out, girl. They are swimming a world-class time." Kathy reminds Barbara, "They've all been training hard over the last few years. Eddie has been swimming a bit more this year." Barbara replies, "Eric works out every day at the high school. It's really quite funny in a way when the track coach is the fastest person in every event. It really makes the team work harder. Tessa, in the lead during most of the second lap, approaches the wall and takes the lead in the third lap. At the end of the second lap, Eddie is in second place and Gina is in third place. During the third lap, getting the distinct impression that she is up against some serious competition, Gina makes up some lost ground. Seeing Eddie take the lead, Kathy comments, "It looks like Eddie found his afterburner." Seeing Eddie pull ahead, Barbara replies, "I see that." Eddie's 50-yard split was 23 seconds. Kathy observes, "Whoever this Gina girl is, she's pretty good." Not ever seeing Gina before, Paula, who has been quietly watching the race, replies, "She's probably on a swimming team somewhere." Early in the last lap, Eddie maintains first place. Tessa gives it all she has and makes up a little ground. The cheering from the sidelines gets louder as the end of the race draws near. The swimmers rapidly approach the finish, and at the wall this year, Eddie touches first, beating Tessa by a few yards. Tessa touches the wall second, beating Gina by a few yards. Gina touches third, delivering quite a respectable performance. Barbara announces to the crowd, "The winner this year is Eddie, with a time of 50.6 seconds, who won by a few yards." Eddie gives Tessa a high five, moves into Gina's lane, where he and Tessa give Gina a high five. Gina tells Eddie and Tessa, "You guys are fast." Tessa tells Gina, "You're pretty fast, yourself." The three swimmers get out of the pool, where Gina carefully looks over her opponents. Desperately wanting to know, Gina asks, "Okay. I have to know. Who are you guys, anyway?" Answering for her and Eddie, Tessa replies, "I'm Tessa Hoffer, previously Tessa Clement. And this guy over here, who was really lucky today, is Eddie Boganskaya." Gina exclaims, "Wait. You're Tessa Clement?" Tessa replies, "That's me." Gina yells out, "You mean, the Tessa Clement that owns the national record in the 100 and 200 meter freestyle?" Tessa replies, "Yeah. That's me. And I can't believe my records still stand." Gina tells Tessa, "Last year, Nina Dotsenrod came close, but she suddenly dropped out of the swimming circuit." Tessa now knows for sure that Gina is a collegiate swimmer. Tessa informs Gina, "And this is Eddie Boganskaya, the fastest man in the world on land, but not in the pool." Eddie laughs at Tessa's commentary and tells Gina, "It's nice to meet you." Slightly upset that she lost the race, Tessa boasts to Gina, "I beat Eddie in this race the last 3 years in a row." Eddie apparently has more training secrets. "I'll have to beat them out of him at lunch." Eddie tells Gina, "Why don't you join us for lunch? I'll spill all my secrets over pizza." Wanting to hear any potential training secrets, Gina replies, "I think I will. Thank you so much." After the competition, Eddie and Tessa take a seat at a table with Mr. Fraser and Coach Layton. Gina, quite surprised to see Coach Layton at the pool with the group, joins them. Taking a seat, Gina asks Coach Layton, "Aren't you Dr. Layton from the university?" Coach Layton replies, "I am. But today, please call me Athena." Gina tells Athena, "I had you for my advanced physical conditioning class last year." Knowing that the advanced physical conditioning class is exclusively for athletes, Athena replies, "You must be on one of our sports teams." Gina replies, "Swimming." Athena also knows that Gina, being on a sports team, received a grade of A in the class. At Eddie's table, the discussion revolves around the university's athletic program. Once lunch is nearly over, Tessa finally gets the chance to ask Eddie, "It's time for you to spill your secrets, buddy." Eddie tells Tessa, "I told you. I've been swimming in the ocean." Tessa exclaims, asking, "That's it?" Eddie replies, "That, and the rest of the training secrets I've told you over the years." Tessa asks, "Nothing else?" Ocean swimming is the only thing you added. Pointing to the pool, Eddie replies, yeah. Swimming in the ocean is hard work. It's a lot harder than swimming in that little puddle over there. Wanting to gain a competitive edge in the pool, Gina asks, what are the other training secrets? Eddie replies, I invented a weight and pulley system to mimic the strokes used in swimming. By adding resistance, you can better develop the muscles used in any of the strokes. And I swim in my pool with my clothes on, creating lots of drag. In a way, it also simulates swimming against resistance. Tessa adds, and it really works. Eddie, Tessa, and Gina discuss a few more training secrets, as Eddie and Tessa come to find out that Gina, who will be a junior this year, swims for the university. At another table, Brayden catches Erica looking around carefully, as if she is expecting an unwanted visitor. Brayden tells Erica, you're looking around like you're expecting trouble. Erica replies, McCrutchen and Evans got bailed out this past week. I'm half thinking they might show up again someday. Brayden laughs and tells Erica, we'll just kick their ass again. Erica smiles and asks Brayden, guess who posted their bond? Brayden replies, I have no idea. Who was dumb enough to bail their asses out? Erica replies, some guy named Larry Gable. He's the track coach at one of the universities in the division. Brayden asks, I thought McCrutchen and Evans worked for Dogpatch University. Erica suggests, it sounds like they got jobs at Dr. Gable's university now that Dr. Nicholson is in hot water. Hearing Erica and Brayden mention Larry Gable's name catches the attention of Coach Athena Layton and Mr. Frazier, who are sitting at an adjacent table talking with Gina. Athena turns around, asking Erica, what's this I hear about Larry Gable? Erica explains, a little while ago, at Eddie's house, Todd McCutchen and Brad Evans got arrested for vandalism and trespassing. Larry Gable posted their bond. Eddie comments, with Dr. Nicholson in jail, it sounds like McCrutchen and Evans jumped ship and work for Dr. Gable now. Erica and Eddie bring Mr. Frazier and Athena up to date on their latest encounter with McCutchen and Evans. Hearing of the altercation with McCutchen and Evans, Mr. Frazier laughs, announcing, just when you think there's smooth sailing ahead, now there's this. Athena replies, I can't wait to hear about this next month during the coaches' meeting. If they won't bring it up, I most certainly will. Eddie mentions, at least one thing is for certain. If Dr. Gable hired McCrutchen and Evans, he's definitely up to something. And it's a dead giveaway that Dr. Gable's team sucks this year. Mr. Frazier laughs and replies, you're probably spot on. Gable's team usually occupies the basement, along with that other guy, whatever his name is. Athena asks Mr. Frazier, would you be talking about Peter Gregory? Mr. Frazier nods his head and replies, that's the guy. Athena sits back and thinks for a moment, then comments, McCutchen and Evans must be bringing something of a highly perceived value to the table for Dr. Nicholson, and now Dr. Gable, to hire them. As far as I can ascertain, neither of them has ever been competitive on the track, in the classroom, nor as a trainer. I'm now wondering what it is that makes these two guys so popular in the track and field circuit. Mr. Frazier suggests they could have some dirt on Gable and forced Gable to hire them. Athena replies, but bail them out of jail, George. That's really quite unusual. Mr. Frazier then suggests, maybe they have a landslide of dirt against Gable. Or, maybe it's the fact that we won every gold medal last season, and they want to know how we did it. Athena replies, I think you hit the nail on the head, George. Knowing that the university's track team had an awesome season last year, Eddie suggests, McCutchen and Evans are probably spying on teams again. Everything they've ever done is underhanded and shady. Eddie then suggests to Mr. Frazier and Athena, if I were you guys, I'd be checking all around that campus during practice, not just in the stadium. They can be sitting somewhere on campus with a parabolic microphone and binoculars, and gathering information. And Lynn Burson has a camera that has a lens that can take a picture of a bird on a telephone pole a quarter mile away. Hoping what Eddie suggested is not true, Mr. Fraser replies, "You know, you might be right about that." Athena tells Mr. Fraser, "We'll get our police department to issue a restraining order against Todd McCutcheon and Brad Evans. If our officers catch them on campus, we'll have them taken in." Now with a way to solve the potential problem, Mr. Fraser replies, "I like that idea." Taking in the conversation, Gina is quite surprised to hear what she is hearing. Gina naively asks the group, "Are you guys saying that teams spy on each other?" Athena replies, "Spying is only the tip of the iceberg. You can be sure that every team in the division knows your performance capabilities just as well as you and your coach do. And at the administrative side of things, the powers that be do everything they can to give their teams an advantage, and at the same time, handing their competitors a disadvantage whenever possible. Some of what they do is underhanded and against the divisional rules. Occasionally, they get caught. But many of them skirt the rules and fly under the radar, and have been doing so for years." Athena knows and understands the issue of skirting the rules all too well. Eddie, Mark, Bobby B., and Athena's son, Daryl Stone, never attended formal classes when they ran for the university, but received a degree nevertheless. The news of Dean Grimsby's involvement in a gambling ring certainly did not help the university's image. But since the time the universities in the division were audited several years ago, the university's athletic program has been squeaky clean. Tessa then informs Gina, "If you notice, on your performance chart, the temperature of the water is recorded along with your times. The pool temperature for a meet is supposed to be between 77 and 82 degrees. During a home meet, Dr. Mulkeen has the pool temperature set to give the team, as a whole, an advantage, and at the same time, giving the opponents a disadvantage if he can. You can be sure other teams do the same thing when the meet is held in their pool." Quite surprised at what Tessa revealed, Gina admits, "I never knew that." Athena informs Gina, "At our university, in track and field, we do similar things to give our team an advantage. For example, there are three flags located at the end of the red zone." Not familiar with track and field terminology, Gina interrupts and asks, "What's the red zone?" Athena continues, "The red zone is the area in the center of the track into where the discus, shot put, hammer, and javelin are thrown. The flags have been purposely placed in that location to give the field athletes an indication of the wind speed and direction. The United States flag is the heaviest of the three and generally will only move in a strong wind. The university flag is the lightest of the three and will move in a slight breeze. The state flag is somewhere in between. If our athletes see the flags are indicating a good tailwind, they'll take advantage of it if they can. If they see a strong headwind, they'll take their time stepping onto the launch pad and wait for the wind to die down. The competing teams also have a perfect view of the flags, but honestly, none of the other teams have ever figured it out as far as I know." Eddie suddenly blurts out, "Tessa can't swim in cold water." Tessa rebuts, "Yes, I can." Eddie replies, "No, you can't. That's part of the reason I beat you in the ocean by a whole 30 yards. The water was in the lower 70s. Now beginning to think that Eddie might just know what he is talking about, Tessa exclaims, "How long have you known this?" Eddie replies, "About 3 minutes." Now intrigued, Athena asks Eddie, "Please share with us how you came to that conclusion." Eddie replies, "I had no idea that, in a swimming meet, the pool temperature has to be between 77 and 82 degrees. The ocean around here is in the lower 70s. Today, the pool temperature is a little cooler, since all last week was on the cloudy side. The last 3 years, when Tessa beat me, if I remember correctly, it was really hot out here. So, the pool temperature was probably in the lower to mid 80s. Athena responds, This comes right back to Kathy's master's thesis. Not recalling the details of Kathy's thesis, Tessa asks, "What's Kathy's thesis about?" Eddie yells out, "Hey, Kathy. Come here for a second." Kathy walks over, asking, "What's up?" Eddie tells Kathy, "Tell Tessa about your thesis." Kathy replies, "My thesis title is Environmental Factors in Exercise Tolerance and Its Effect on Reactive Deconditioning Syndromes in Well-Conditioned Athletes. It was about how environmental factors affect performance. Like, if you always run when the temperature is 72 degrees, your performance will be great when it's 72 degrees outside, but will pretty much suck when it's 60 degrees or 90 degrees." Tessa and Gina listen carefully as Kathy goes on and describes her research in detail. Once Kathy has finished summarizing her thesis material, Eddie tells Tessa and Gina, "If you want to improve your performance, you should be swimming in 60-degree water, 90-degree water, in the ocean, and in a pool. If you train in extreme conditions, the body adapts and will perform better in all conditions. Me and Kathy don't even turn our air conditioner on at home anymore because the heat doesn't bother us." Eddie then specifically tells Gina, "Then, when the opposing coach adjusts the pool temperature to give his team an advantage, it won't matter to you." Gina reveals, "I never knew all this stuff. Everything sounds a whole lot more complicated than train hard and do your best at the meet." Hearing Eddie's and Kathy's analysis, Athena suggests to Mr. Fraser, "Perhaps we should investigate offering an advanced physical conditioning 2 class where this material can be shared in the classroom. And in the associated lab, we can put the theories to the test." Mr. Fraser replies, "That's a good idea. And it would definitely give all of our athletic teams an advantage. Which, as both coaches know, translates to more money for the university." Gina, on lifeguard duty today, has to go back to work. Gina tells the group, "Thank you guys so much for all the information. I learned more today about how things really work than I ever thought." Athena replies, "No problem. I think we've all learned something here today. And I'm so glad you could join us for lunch." Gina gets back to work, and it's now lunchtime for Laura, the head lifeguard. After lunch, many in the group get into the water to cool off. Hanging out in the corner of the pool, Kathy asks Karen Coy, "What have you been up to, girl?" Karen explains, "I finished my PhD, but you already know that. The big news is I got a job teaching at the university." Kathy exclaims, "When did you find this out?" Karen replies, "I officially found out last week. But Athena told me that I got the job a few weeks ago. But she told me not to say anything." Kathy tells Karen, "Congratulations." Kathy could have easily found out that Karen was hired, for her father, Alexander Karakova, is still the athletic director at the university and is the one who hired Karen. Now wondering, Kathy asks Karen, "Are you still going to be working with the university's team?" Karen replies, "Yes. But now it's official. I got massive amounts of class credit for working with the team, but now I'll get paid. And I won't be working with Coach Johnson at the high school anymore." Kathy tells Karen, "Johnson is really going to miss you." Karen informs Kathy, "He said he has a few students that will make great student assistants. So, he's going that route next year." Seeing that Johnson is following closely in Mr. Fraser's footsteps, Kathy smiles and replies, "During the track dedication at the high school, I remember seeing at least a half dozen high school girls with stopwatches hanging around their necks." Karen explains, "Over at the high school, being a student assistant with the track team seems to be a very prestigious and coveted position. Last year, there were about 20 girls who wanted the job. Coach Johnson picked 7 of them." Curious of Johnson's methodology in choosing the team assistants, Kathy asks, "How did Johnson pick the 7 girls?" Karen replies, "He gave them a written test on track and field. Then, He made them time several events and take a few field measurements. Whoever came closest to Johnson's times and measurements got the job. Now even more curious, Kathy asks, what was on the written test? Karen laughs and explains, the test was ridiculously simple. You had to get all of the questions right to be considered. The test had a picture of all the equipment used in track and field, like a picture of a shot put, discus, high jump apparatus, starting blocks, and so on in column A. And you had to pick the name of each item in column A from column B. Kathy giggles, telling Karen, that sounds like something Johnson would do. Kathy asks, how have things been with your mother? Karen replies, if you're talking about my former babysitter, well, we don't talk anymore. She has such a crappy attitude. I still talk to my dad, though. And Aunt Jeannie is no longer my Aunt Jeannie. I call her Mom now. So, I see my real mom during all the holidays and over the weekends a lot. Kathy smiles, telling Karen, that's really nice. No one deserves all the shit your former babysitter gave you. Mitchell, sitting back talking with Mark, asks, how's that town over there where you, Eddie, and Bobby B. live? Mark replies, it's kind of quiet, and it will probably stay that way. All the homes are on 2 to 3 acres, so you're not right on top of your neighbor, which is really nice. Mitchell reveals, Amber wants to move. Mark asks, why? Mitchell explains, we live 2 towns over. She feels like we're out of the action. Everyone else pretty much lives close together. Making the solution sound easy, Mark replies, so, move. Mitchell mentions, Johnson and Braden live in the same neighborhood. They say they like it there. Mark informs Mitchell, Johnson bought that house because he could walk to the high school if he wanted to. It's only a half mile away. That's really a nice neighborhood. Mitchell replies, Amber wants to move in closer. I agree with her. It's probably best. Mark suggests to Mitchell, there are a couple of vacant lots in the town where I live. I've bought a few of them. So has Eddie. If you want one of them, I'm sure we can arrange something. And I can custom build something for you. If you stay closer to the south end, near the high school, you'll be close to the train station. Mitchell replies, Amber and I are going to start looking around next weekend. Mark informs Mitchell, you've been in Johnson's and Braden's houses. Their houses have been completely remodeled. So, if you buy a house in their neighborhood, you'll probably want to update everything. Some of those houses were built back in the 1950s. And they are built really well. Mitchell replies, that's a good point. Mitchell tells Mark, I guess I should get moving on this and put my house up for sale. Mark asks, why sell it? Just buy what you want, and rent out the one you're living in now. Mitchell, who is always the most intelligent one in the group, replies, yeah. That's right. We don't have to wait for our house to sell in order to move. Mitchell, now more convinced that moving will be easier than he thought, plans to get the ball rolling. Later in the afternoon, off in a corner of the pool, Eddie and Athena are discussing financial issues, specifically the stock market and money. Athena still cannot figure out how Eddie's stock market picks always return an enormous profit within 3 to 6 months. Neither can Athena's husband, Mike, who is supposedly a financial expert. With many questions, Athena asks Eddie, "May I ask why you don't hold stocks for the long term?" Eddie explains, "Well, I still own 2 utility stocks that return a nice dividend. But, to answer your question, just because I have a piece of paper that says I own a stock, that doesn't mean I really own anything. That company could be gone tomorrow, and the stock will be worthless. Stocks, and the bills you have in your wallet, really have no value at all. I take some of the money I earn in the stock market, and turn it into a tangible asset." Athena asks, "How is it that you can say the bills in my wallet have no value?" Eddie replies, "A dollar bill is currency, not money. Gold is real money. If the whole world falls apart tomorrow, and all currencies fail, what's left standing? It will be gold, silver, real estate, and anything else tangible. I mean, look what happened during the Great Depression. The Great Depression affected what the Wall Street guys call financial instruments. The farmer out west who had no debt wasn't really affected by the depression. He still ate well and made a living. In any economy, there's always a demand for food. So, a farm is a tangible asset. A stock certificate is not. They can print dollar bills, as many as they want. They can't print real estate. They can't print gold. And they certainly can't print food. And when it comes to debt, the universal law is what? Can't be paid, won't be paid. But no one ever wants to talk about that. Athena agrees, telling Eddie, that's certainly one subject no one ever touches on, certainly not in any classes given at the university. Now curious, Athena asks Eddie, what do you think the dollar is backed by? Eddie explains, everyone says the dollar is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. That's bullshit. The dollar is backed by the United States military. Athena agrees, telling Eddie, that's a good point. You'll never hear that espoused in a finance class. Eddie replies, that's because the government doesn't want anyone to know what really backs the dollar. Athena observes, it's no surprise, then, why we spend so much on our military. Eddie replies, exactly. Eddie then goes on, explaining, when the dollar was backed by gold and we had silver coins, that was money, not currency. Now, it's backed by nothing tangible, other than the threat of physical force. Eddie then laughs, telling Athena, you know, the dollar really is backed by something. It's a metal. It's called erodium. Erodium is a metal that erodes away over time. If you put 10 ounces of erodium in a safe, lock it up, and come back 5 years later, you'll only find 8 ounces of erodium. Athena laughs and replies, that's usually called inflation. Eddie, who has been studying the financial system for years, mentions, that's another interesting subject. The government needs a small amount of inflation to keep their currency engine going. Eddie then asks Athena, what happens when the inflation rate is higher than the interest rate? Knowing the answer quite well, Athena replies, the entire financial system will eventually fall off a cliff. Everything will be in turmoil. And, I might add, anyone who has the ability would convert their cash to tangible assets. Eddie points out, why wait until the disaster strikes? Once the rush comes to get into tangible assets, the price of the asset will skyrocket. A light goes off in Athena's head, who finally understands where Eddie is coming from. As the afternoon winds down, many in the group head home. A few who don't have kids that are falling asleep head to the pizzeria. On their way home, Kathy mentions to Eddie, it's kind of nice that everything went smoothly today. Eddie replies, hopefully, all the crazy people are gone for good. But there are a few more out there. They'll be more of Johnson's and Mr. Fraser's problem. Kathy asks, really? Like who? Eddie replies, well, there's Mr. Brian, Mr. Harrison, Mr. Ryan, McCrutchen's itty-bitty little brother Jeff, and now this Larry Gable guy. And that's just a start. Pulling into the driveway, Kathy tells Eddie, I think we might have an evening together. Eddie Jr. fell asleep. Trying not to wake up his son, Eddie carries him inside and puts Eddie Jr. to bed. Later that night, Johnson is at home with Barbara. Barbara receives a call from Wendy, who asks her, hey, do you guys want to come over and join us at our pool for a while? Barbara replies, we'd love to. But we may not be able to stay too long since it's getting close to George's bedtime. Wendy tells Barbara, we're in the backyard. The gate is open. Just come on back. Johnson and Barbara walk around the block, and walk into the Braden's backyard. Braden tells Johnson, take a look at Hunter. He was in the pool all day at the park. And now, he's gonna stay in the pool all night. Johnson replies, maybe not. He sees George, and now he's getting out. Braden figures, they'll play for a while, and then he'll be back in the water. Johnson suggests that's because if he stops, he'll fall asleep. As Hunter and George play with toys, the two couples take a seat at a poolside table. Johnson comments, it looks a lot better around here with the Chucky's house gone. Wendy quickly replies, yeah. I'd say so. Braden informs Johnson and Barbara, I'm gonna buy the Chucky's house. It's going up for sale on the courthouse steps next month, and Mr. Davies is gonna be doing the auction. Ain't nobody gonna outbid me. Barbara asks Braden, what are you going to do with the property? Braden replies, I'm gonna remove the driveway, the walkway, the slab, and let the lot return to its natural condition. Barbara replies, wow. That is going to look really nice. Johnson mentions, I hear Mark is going to demolish Dave's house and going to build a wall. Braden replies, it's gonna look real good. Wendy is gonna have a really nice garden next year. Johnson asks Braden, why are you buying all these houses and not doing anything with them? Braden replies, I'm glad you asked. I got a plan, bro. Wendy interjects, and it's a good plan, too. Barbara tells Braden, out with it. I really want to hear this. Braden explains, you guys know how quiet and peaceful it is up there where Eddie and those guys live. Well, I was thinking that, whenever a house comes up for sale around here, I can buy it, knock it down, and let the property go back to its natural condition. Then, we can have a quiet neighborhood in the woods right here in the town. Barbara looks at her husband and tells him that would really look nice. Johnson replies, and it would really make this neighborhood an exclusive area. Braden further explains, there are 75 houses in this neighborhood. Most of them are on a half acre. Right now, there are two houses for sale. So, I was thinking about taking some of the money I made in the stock market and buying houses around here. Barbara quickly suggests, we can help and buy some of the houses too. Braden replies, that would be a big help. Wendy adds, I really like this area. It's so close to everything. It would be a lot nicer if there were more trees and it was more natural. Barbara energetically announces, we're in. So, Braden's plan of eliminating 3/4 of the homes in his neighborhood is put into motion. Once Mitchell and Amber get home, Mitchell asks, do you want to go out for a run? Amber replies, yes and no. Mitchell asks, what part is yes? Amber replies, I want to go out for a run, but not out on the road. Mitchell asks, what part is no? Amber replies, if I'm going to cover any distance, I'll have to fight the traffic. It's Saturday evening, when all the drunks are out on the road. And I really don't feel like running in the sand at the beach or on a track somewhere. Mitchell replies, I can get that. Mitchell suggests, we can always take the portal to somewhere at a different time. Amber replies, I know. But I just want to walk out of my front door and run. That's not too easy to do around here. And besides, I really want to move. I don't like it here anymore. All of our friends live where we grew up. Beating around the bush, Amber finally got to the subject that she wants to discuss with her husband. Mitchell suggests, so, let's move. We can start looking for something tomorrow. All excited at hearing her husband's openness to moving, Amber exclaims, how about now? Let's see what's for sale. Mitchell logically asks, where do you want to move to? With no shortage of energetic words, Amber replies, I want to live in the town behind the high school. Eddie and Kathy, Mark and Paula, Bobby B., and Erica all live there. And Axel and Wendy, and Eric and Barbara all live right across the main road. I really want to live near our friends. Mitchell was hoping that was the case, and that Amber did not change her mind. Mitchell, realizing that he has to get this project moving, tells Amber, "Let me call Mark." Amber asks, "Why call Mark?" Mitchell explains, "I talked to Mark earlier today. He said he owns a couple of vacant lots in the town behind the high school, and so does Eddie." Amber exclaims, "Yeah. That's the ticket. Call Mark now." Mitchell calls Mark, who is glad to give Mitchell the addresses of the properties he owns, Eddie owns, and Bobby B. owns. After a 15-minute conversation, Mitchell hangs up the phone and tells Amber, "Between Mark, Eddie, and Bobby B., they own 11 properties in that town. I wrote down the addresses." All excited, Amber grabs the list, gets out a map of the area, marking where the properties are. Once she is finished marking the location of each property on the map, Amber tells Mitchell, "Okay. We're going to look at them." Mitchell asks, "Now?" Amber smiles and replies, "Yeah. Like right now." Mitchell and Amber head out the door, in search of their next home. Mark and Paula, after putting Mark Jr. and Dawn to bed, relax outside by their pool. Paula mentions to Mark, "There's definitely something up with Erica." Mark asks, "How do you know?" Paula explains, "She's been really quiet today." Mark confesses, "Wow. I didn't even notice." Paula replies, "She said a little bit to Braden and Athena, talking about police work. But, most of the afternoon, she just sat at a table, staring out into space." Mark suggests, "Maybe she had a long week at work." Paula replies, "Nope. My superpowers are telling me otherwise." Mark tells Paula, "I guess we'll find out soon enough." Paula asks, "What did Mitchell want when he called?" Mark explains, "He wants to move. He and Amber are getting tired of living far away from everyone. I gave him the addresses of the properties that Eddie, Bobby B., and we own. He's going to look at them sometime." Paula asks, "Why did they move all the way over there, anyway?" Mark replies, "I don't really know. I think it was because he had a straight shot to the train station." Paula mentions, "It will be really nice having them live closer." Paula stretches and yawns, and tells Mark, "It's been a long day." Mark replies, "It's been a long year, too. We did a lot this year." Paula optimistically mentions, "Hopefully, next year, we can have a little more of a normal life." Mark replies, "Yeah. But, you know that ain't happening. Nothing ever goes as planned." Paula yawns again, and tells Mark, "I want to go to bed." Paula and Mark head inside, calling it a day. Returning from the county pool, Bobby B. and Erica sit outside relaxing by their poolside. Bobby B. tells Erica, "You've been really quiet today." Erica replies, "I know." Bobby B. asks, "Any reason why?" Erica replies, "I think I'm pregnant." Bobby B. smiles and exclaims, "Really? When did you find this out?" Erica replies, "I figured it out when we were at the pool. I'm a week late. I've never been late in my life." Bobby B. quickly suggests, "Let's go to the drugstore and get a pregnancy test." Suddenly energetic, Erica replies, "Oh, yeah. We can do that." Bobby B. and Erica head out, with Erica driving. Since Erica is a police officer, she can more easily get away with breaking the speed limit than the average Joe on the street. When they return home, Erica makes a beeline to the bathroom. Bobby B. stands outside the door, asking, "Well, what did it say?" Erica replies, "Nothing yet." 10 seconds later, Bobby B. impatiently asks, "Anything yet?" Erica replies, "No. I'll let you know." Bobby B. paces the hallway and rushes to the door when he hears the toilet flush. Erica opens the door announcing, "We're having a baby." Bobby B gives Erica a big hug and exclaims, "Awesome." Bobby B energetically suggests, "We can invite our parents out to eat tomorrow and tell them. And then we can go shopping for baby things. And what else? We have a lot of stuff to do." Erica suggests, "How about we just go out with our parents to eat tomorrow? We have a lot of time to get everything else done. It's not like I'm delivering the baby tomorrow." Quickly realizing he was jumping the gun, Bobby B replies, "Oh, yeah. That's right." Bobby B and Erica call it a night and head to bed, not likely to fall asleep very quickly in their wired state. Later that night, after Eddie Jr. goes to bed, Eddie and Kathy go outside in their pool for a late evening swim. Looking up into the sky, Kathy tells Eddie, "There's my star." Knowing exactly where Katarina's star is, Eddie replies, "It's very bright tonight." Kathy puts her legs around Eddie's hips as he moves around the pool. Kathy tells Eddie, "Our son needs his own star." Eddie replies, "We'll find one for him." Kathy closes her eyes, puts her head on Eddie's shoulder and tells him, "I love you." Eddie whispers in Kathy's ear, "I love you."